Make it rain.
I'm grateful to be in recovery. My name is Akil. And before I even get into what I'm going to get into, I want to thank the God of my understanding for this moment, for allowing me to make a choice and place me in a program that's life-changing, life-transforming. And then he gave me some people to practice this thing with. He gave me y'all. So I'm forever grateful. It ain't no secret. I drank and I smoked crack. But I'm not going to start with the crack, because then we might as well just circle up right now. You know what I mean? So I will tell you a little bit about myself. I'm not going to drug a log y'all out. I'm not going to do that. Harlem born, Brooklyn, Queens raised. That's me. I'm the product of Caribbean parents from the island of St. Vincent and St. Thomas. I grew up with parents who were Garveyites. Marcus Garvey was their dude. And I grew up with a sense of purpose as a black man, not from an exclusionary point, but to be proud of who I was and that you come from something. And no matter what society may throw at you, try to remember that you are someone. And it's ironic because my mom, God rest her, my mom's never got high. She never drank. My father never drank. My father never even used a cuss word before. And that used to really trip me out. The Odyssey started real quick. 13. I'm living in Queens. Got my man B. He lived behind me. He got a 40 dog. Old English. He got some weed. Next thing I know, it was the next day. I passed out, blacked out. They don't remember nothing. But you know how it is in New York. Be so ruthless. He didn't even make sure. He took me to the fence, pushed me over. I fell in my mom's rose bushes. He left me there. My sister had to come outside, you know, take care of me. But the next day, I was like, yo, can we do that again? And yo, so that started the Odyssey, man, you know. And just like all of us, we went through the progression of this and this and that. You know, growing up, though, I don't know if anybody else has West Indian parents, but I had a dad. My dad passed a year ago, November. And my dad, West Indian men are hard, man. They are. My father was 80 years old, and my father told me that he loved me like one time in my whole life. And that's an issue that I'm still dealing with, you know. But the one thing I did like about my father, he was a provider. He was a man's man. My dad, when he was coming up, was a prospect in the AA for the New York Yankees, but he was only 17 years old. And my grandmother wouldn't let him play. So whatever inclinations he had towards sports, he poured into me. And it was funny because I'm the kid that I got the good grades in school. I played ball. I didn't look like I would do anything. But that was that Jekyll and Hyde syndrome, because after school, it was on. My life changed when my parents got divorced at 16. Everybody wanted to stay home with moms. Nobody wanted to go with dad. Dad moved to Brooklyn. I said, I'm going to go with dad. I went to Brooklyn one time. I never went back to Queens ever. I never went back. It was a wrap. Brooklyn turned me out the first weekend I was there. I can't even explain Brooklyn to you then, but it was different. And it was different. And as we got older, you know, things happened. And I was graduating high school, and progression was starting. I didn't know it was progression at the time, but it was happening. And I had scholarships to play at a bunch of Division II schools, three Division I schools. You know, I had some stuff. And I passed the SAT, and I did all of this. But for the life of me, when it was time to enroll, I couldn't leave the block. I couldn't get off Flatbush Avenue to save my life. And that began the resentment that built between me and my father, because I did have the ability to play. And he never forgave me for that. He never forgave me for that. And, you know, growing up in New York, it was different. But the one thing, just like any other neighborhood, community was community. I can remember I'm walking down the block. My father and my mom live on in this building. My grandmother lived in the building down the street. And I happened to be walking by the building, and my grandmother was coming out. I was cussing like a longshoreman, and I didn't know she was standing there. My grandmother slapped me in my mouth so hard, and it was her best friend, Miss Clara, who also slapped me in the mouth. So, you know, you remember, you know, moms, if moms don't and pops don't hear it, then somebody else gonna hear it. They're going to get on you, and then they're going to tell your parents, and you're going to catch it. So progression, as time went on, I started to experiment with a whole lot of different stuff. Towards the end, I remember it well. I got you. I remember it well. December 1984. They was talking about this thing on the news. They was talking about Freeway, Ricky Ross. And they was talking about this thing called crack. And I heard it. I heard about crack. But I had never tried it. And I had a friend. And I'm sure I ain't the only one who had a friend like this. My man's name was Bear. He was from Virginia, but he had moved to Brooklyn. And Bear was the type of dude, I don't care what time you called his house. I don't care what was going on at his house. You tell Bear, yo, listen, man, I got this, that, and that. Bear had three words all day long. What you waiting on? What you waiting on? And I can remember this last time I went to Bear's house, and I come in and I go in the living room like I normally do. And I got a little bit of this and I got a little bit of that and I got some of that liquid. And I'm fixing stuff and I'm shaking cigarettes and I'm, you know, I'm doing what I do. But I noticed he in the kitchen and the door's closed. And I didn't know what that meant at the time. So I finally, after 30 minutes, I knocked on the door. I'm like, yo, what y'all doing? I got all this shit out here. What? I look, and I see his wife, and she got this glass thing. And I look on the stove, and the stove is bubbling, and there's a baby bottle in the stove, in the water, and it's doing this thing. And I'm like, what are y'all doing? He said, we freebasing. And the only recollection I had of freebasing was Richard Pryor getting burnt up. That's the only recollection I had. So I'm saying, I said, wait a minute. I said, ain't that the stuff that burnt up Richard Pryor? Bear said, he wasn't doing it right. He wasn't doing it right. That was all I needed. I said, so you telling me there's a way to do this and you don't get burnt up? Bear said, yeah. Because Bear, he was a man of few words. So I said, yo, let me try that. And he looked at me. And in all sincerity, he said, man, you don't want this. You don't want to try this. So how are you going to tell a vet that get high, I don't want to try something? And for like 30 minutes, I'm like, yo, man, come on, B. What? Come on, let's do this. Let me do this thing. I warned you. You don't want this. Man. And he was right. Because that night was the first night I freebased. And we ran out. I had that stuff. We ran out. So now we wide open. I said, what are we going to do now? He said, we're going down to the castle. And the castle was this joint on East 21st and Church Avenue. It looked like the New Jack City building. You know them old New York City, New York buildings where you walk in the courtyard. It's a big courtyard, building here, building there. And they in there doing that thing. And he came out with a long tube. I said, yo, what is that? It's a jumbo. I said, what the hell is a jumbo? And I'm looking at it, and these little yellow pieces of something, it looked like stucco. That was it for me. I didn't go to work for 3 days. I didn't wash for 3 days. This is off the rip. And the funny thing about my job, I live 2 stops from my job. 2 stops. Get on the train at Prospect Park, 7th Avenue, Atlantic Avenue. I'm downtown. And I used to go to work every day talking about the train was late. They know where I live, though. And I'm telling them the train is late. Man, I took a ride that was outrageous. I used that drug so much that I started having physical ailments. My skin started breaking out. My skin started peeling. I was looking like an alligator. And they telling me, yo, you all right? Yeah, man, I'm good. I'm good. But I lost my apartment. I just lost it all. At the end, I was working at this homeless shelter in downtown Brooklyn on Hanson Place. And we were only using the first 2 floors. And everything above the first 2 was abandoned. So it was about 6 floors. I stole the key. Well, you know what we do. I stole the key. So I can get in the building. And I live on the abandoned floor above the shelter. And one day, man, the last day I used, I had gotten paid. And the money was gone within 2 hours. So I'm standing on Fulton Street in South Elliott. And there was a check cashing place right on the corner. And I see this dude going in the check cashing place. And those of us in the street, you know when somebody looks sweet, they look sweet. I said, he looks sweet. So I still had a little pistol. And I relieved a brother of his transaction. But this insanity was, I took the dude's money, I ran him off the corner, I went to cop, and then I got high on the same corner. Not thinking about retribution, not thinking, yo, something can happen to me, they can come back. All I could think about was I needed to get high. And I went back up in an abandoned building, and I stood there, and I smoked till it was all gone. And the insanity of it, you know how it is in abandoned buildings in New York. They used to paint the windows black. And I'm standing in front of this window. And I'm looking out the window. And I'm looking out the window. And I'm trying to figure out why I can't see out the window. Didn't dawn on me, if you chip off some of the paint, you might be able to see out the window. And I'm standing there for hours. I wasn't a geeker and peeker. I just stood there. I was stuck. So I got on my makeshift bed. I had a bed, and it was like a table like this. And then I put another table on top the other way, so to lay in between. And then I had these things where, because it's running, rats and shit is running all around. Yeah. So that was my makeshift bed, and I sat there on the bed. And I heard was, this ain't it. I didn't know what it meant. But this ain't it. This can't be it. I went downstairs the next day, took a shower in the showers, went to the director of the program and the social worker there. I said, I think I got a problem with drugs. And she started clapping. She said, we had been waiting for you. So what I did, from that day on, I didn't use. And I'm waiting to get into treatment. And the EAP is down on Chamber Street, near where the World Trade Center used to be. So for 2 weeks, I'm white knuckling it. I mean, I'm not drinking, I'm not smoking, I ain't doing nothing. I finally got back in the EPA. They called me and told me to come down to Chamber Street, and I went down there, and she's calling places. But while she's calling places, I got $20 in my pocket. I got a hot 20. Got a hot 20 in my pocket. So I'm thinking, you know how, as addicts, we equate money with things. $20 equals a dime, a nickel bag, and a 40. That's $20. I can do all of that with 20. Go to City Hall Park and get right. And I'm sitting there, and that's what I'm going to do. And she said to me, can you go tomorrow? And I stood there, and I saw myself say yes. And I went back to Brooklyn. By that time, within that 2 week period, my father let me back in the house. Now, my father and my stepmother, I call them moms, and my stepmother, I took everything they had. I stole my grandmother's wedding ring that she gave to my mom and pawned it. I did it all. I did all of that. I was one of those guys that stole from those closest to him. At the end of my story, I would go back to Queens and I would have a laundry bag with my clothes, and my mother wouldn't let me in the house, but she would feed me and she would wash my clothes. My mother, whenever I came around, yo, my moms would take her purse, wrap it around her, get two house coats, wrap them around and tie them up whenever I came around. Because my mother said, ain't no telling what gonna be missing when you leave here. So she knew I would do something. But at the end of the day, man, I went and got some help. And I didn't really, I didn't know about recovery. I heard about AA. But I didn't know how it worked. I'm thinking you could stop smoking crack, stop drinking. You can hit that non-addictive marijuana every now and then. This is what I'm thinking. So when they gave me the address of the place, the place was on East 77th between 1st and New York. This place was so freaking swanky that when I walked by and I saw the address, I said, this can't be the hospital. And I kept walking back and forth, because I'm thinking I'm lost. Security came outside. Hey, man, what you doing? I said, I'm looking for so-and-so hospital. He said, this is it. I go inside, give him my name. They got the bed. But you know, you got to get searched. So I don't know that people who go to treatment, they be trying to smuggle stuff. I don't know that. So the man, he putting on a glove. I'm like, yo, what you putting a glove on for? He said, I got to search you. I said, you just searched me. He said, no, I got to search you. Hey, yo, I stood there for like 20 minutes, me and this dude going back and forth. I said, he said, yeah. But something in me said, you know what? You're going to have to take one for the team if you say you want this help. So I took one for the team. And when I got upstairs, man, it was lunchtime. And by then, man, I was a small dude anyway. By then, I was jacked up. And we ate. And, you know, brother was sitting there. He didn't want his tray. I was like, yo, I got you. I'll take it. That's when I heard the message. Later on that night, they said, we're going to have people come from H&I and bring NA meetings up here nightly. I said, bring who? And the first time I sat in a circle and I heard somebody say, my name is so-and-so and I'm an addict. I said, they just admitting that shit out loud like that? So I'm like, okay. So I followed suit. But what happened during that first, and I was only in treatment for 7 days because I didn't shoot heroin. They told me 7 days was all they can give me. That's all it was. So, but I started hearing people coming up there, and I started seeing people, and I met one dude that, two guys, they were talking about going on a trip. It was a fundraiser they was getting ready to go. And it was going to be Harlem NA guys playing ball against the D.C. guys. And my ears perked. Because prior to that, I stopped playing ball. I hadn't touched a basketball in a while. And I told him, yo, I play ball. And he was like, yeah, okay. Meet me at this meeting when you get out. And we'll see what you got going on. And when the time came for me to get out that day, they let me go early. But I remember they talked about, don't go home, don't go kiss the wife, take your baggage and everything and go. And at that time they let me go. The only meeting or NA meeting that was going on was a place called the Howl Club, better known as St. Mark's the Zoo. And I went down to the zoo. Let me tell you about the zoo. People be kicking. They was kicking dope in there. People were shooting dope in there. In the meeting. As the meeting's going on. Yeah, it was one of them kind of places. People ODing in the bathroom. And I was like, what the hell is this? But what got my attention was a big old, this dude was getting, they were doing the clean time. And he had 78 days clean. I thought he was God. 78 days clean. And I listened and I heard everything I heard needed to hear. And I took suggestions and I got numbers. But what really did it for me was, there was this little Spanish lady named Wilda R. And she walked up to me and she put her hands on my face. She said, I love you. We want you to come back. And by that time, you know, I got kicked out everywhere I went. And that began. And I stayed clean and I started playing ball and started playing ball with my sponsor. That's how it worked. And up and down the East Coast for years playing ball. Philly, Jersey, Baltimore, Boston. We had a crew. Our team was so good. We played in pro-am tournaments. That's how good our team was. And I moved down here. 7 years into the game, I moved down here. And Atlanta confused me greatly. And I'm going to tell you why they confused me. I went to meetings, and they kept talking about dope, and they kept talking about dope, and they kept talking about dope. And I'm saying to myself, damn, for us, heroin is dope. So I couldn't make the connection. And I'm thinking everybody down here is on heroin. And I'm like, I don't think I belong here. This is Dope Anonymous. I couldn't figure it out until somebody broke it down to me. Down here, we say everything is dope. I said, okay, I got it. And at first I was vilified for being down here. I don't want to hear that New York shit. But the New York shit was the only shit I had. I hadn't recovered nowhere else. All I was doing was sharing what I knew. And it was daunting at first. And I stopped going. I stopped going for a little while. I didn't like it. Because I wasn't accepted. And it wasn't so much that I wasn't accepted. I had to rewind the tape and realize, instead of identifying, I was comparing. And I was looking for an excuse not to go. Because it was different. And I didn't want to embrace the change. The change scared me. And I didn't like it. I moved out here in 1991. December 1998, I was in Cobb County Jail, locked up. Looking at 88 years. And this is the part of the story that I gotta tell. I don't tell it that often, but I'm gonna tell it. Without going into particulars and details, when it was time to go to court, I got a lawyer. My family hired this dude out of DeKalb County, and I'm thinking, this brother, he gonna fight for me. And we gonna do our thing, and he ain't scared. And because the thing was, it was a hearsay case, and I didn't know there was a hearsay law in Georgia. I didn't know if I say Cliff robbed me, and I can give you Cliff's name, they gonna go get Cliff, and Cliff ain't did nothing to me. I didn't know that, so I went to a Georgia court with a New York state of mind. You're going to lose every time. So after everything was done, the man said, you either take this 20, do 10, or we're going to hit you with the whole 88. And I'm sitting there. And I left the courtroom and went in the back. And I prayed and I cried and I did a whole lot of stuff. And I took that 20, right? And I'm going to tell you something, man. Life changed. Life changed. But I will say this. I took the principles of Narcotics Anonymous with me. And this is the funny, this is the irony of this. I went to a prison that had meetings 3 days a week. Now, I couldn't see the mercy piece there. I was still stuck with, this is effed up. I'm sitting here. I shouldn't be sitting here. You know, I'm caught up. And one day, I'm on the dorm, and the dude's, you know, he's in his house, and it's an old white dude. Dude got like 3 life sentences. He ain't never coming home. But he got this blue book on his bed. And I'm walking past, and I'm like, so I knocked on his door because, you know, been on the dorm with him for a while. I said, what book is that? And I knew what it was. And he told me the book. He said, it's the AA Big Book. He said, you know anything about that? I said, yeah, I know something. But we never talked for like a whole week. And finally, he cornered me, came to my house, knocked on the door, and he brought the book with him. He said, let's have a talk about this book. So here go God doing for me what I can't do for myself. So I shared some of my story with him. But I would never go to the meeting. I wouldn't go. Them twins wouldn't let me go. Ego and image would not let me go to the meeting. I got 13 years clean at the time. I don't belong here. Shame and guilt wouldn't let me go participate in the recovery process that I had started in New York because I was feeling shame. I was feeling guilt. All of this. About a week later, this dude got tired of me. He said, look, the meeting starts at 6. We going to be up there at 5:45. You need to have your ass up there with us because we need you and your experience. I was sitting up there at 5:30 waiting on them. And that started the process. And I started making meetings again. And I was making meetings inside. A brother that raised me in Queens, a brother named Jeff Not God. When I tell you, and this is not an exaggeration, when I tell you for 10 years, this man wrote me every day. He wrote me every day. And I started doing step work through the mail and on phone calls. And it just became so, I just got in it. I got in it. And time started moving by. My sponsor was coming down to see me, him and his wife. And every chance they got, they would come see me. And it was always the time when this was going on. And he would come and tell me, and this happened, and this happened, and this many people came, and we were doing this. And I'm like, I want to be a heavy hitter. I want to be one of them dudes. And I was telling the brothers in the 25 and over, my sponsor introduced me to y'all before I knew any of y'all. Because by the time I got here and I got out, 2 things happened. I got out on a Friday, so I was able to make my religious service, which was just such a blessing. But the next day was the heavy hitters. And them brothers welcomed me like I'd always been there. And I'd never seen anything like that. I'd never experienced anything like that. And here it is. And I told a story earlier. The first person I saw was Jewel. And Jewel, looking at me, Jewel got tears running down his face, talking about, man, we've been waiting for you.
Yeah.
We've been waiting for you. And I was like, they've been waiting for... And then I met Snook. And Snook was in the kitchen cooking. And he was telling me about cigars. And I'm like, okay. But the bottom line is, man, I did that 10 and a half. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I did that 10 and a half. Whew, boy, did I do it. Nothing ever happened to me from a physical standpoint. I didn't get violated. I fought. You got to fight. It's prison. You got to fight. But I was never violated. I was able to practice my way of life, Narcotics Anonymous, and my religious way of life. And it just built a foundation. So then when it came time to get released, then I was scared to death. The day they let me go, Reggie was right there. And Reggie's standing on the other side of the gate. And the gate goes up. The air's different. It looks different. It smells different. But as I'm standing there, he's standing there, and I'm looking at him. And, you know, I couldn't move my feet. I stood there, and he didn't rush me. He just looked me in my eyes, and I'm looking at him because I was frightened. I was afraid. I mean, scared to death. And then he finally said to me, he said, come on, we got to go because God got something for you to do.
Yeah.
And that gave me the motivation to get up and just take a step. For the last 9 years, I've been dealing with knocks on the door at 2 o'clock in the morning, even after just getting home from work, making sure I'm there. In the beginning, I couldn't go nowhere. When I first came home and wanted to come down here, they wouldn't even let me travel down here. Couldn't do nothing. For 9 years, I put up with that. And towards the end, the last 2 years, I got somebody, a PO who was a little more sympathetic, and I started traveling. And I started going places, and I started doing things. November 15th that just passed, I am no longer on parole. I am no longer on probation. I'm done with it. And the thing is, people need to know that jail is still a yet for a lot of y'all. It is, but you don't have to. Listen to my experience. You don't want to do it. Being disconnected from your family, from this fellowship, from anything and everyone that loves you, that shows you love, to go and actually have to like live like an animal. You have to become a different person in prison. And whoever's been, I ain't talking about jail. I'm talking about prison. And anybody else who's ever been there, you know what I'm talking about. It's a whole nother mindset. So here it is now. I'm not on it no more. Life is different. Life is a lot different. I went to the world this year. And I'm going to tell you one of the things. When I first got out, that really, really, I was still having a resentment from with y'all when I first came down here and didn't want to make meetings. But this is what did it. There was a convention in Grapevine, Texas. Now, I don't know Benji. I'd never seen Benji before. But Benji, Reggie, and three other addicts came to my house, told me to pack a bag. We going to Texas. Let's go. This is when I first got out, and I went. And I wish I could tell you, the crying we did in that van, the meetings that we had in that van. And I remember Benji was the banquet speaker. And Benji was sharing his story. And he was talking about me in the story. And I was like, it blew me away. And I didn't know that I had an impact on him like that. So this year, I saw him at the world. Boy, I was cheering, boy. I was cheering. Because I was proud of him. Because that's my friend. That's my brother. And I was able to do some things. So here it is now. I work in two restaurants. And I'm a bartender. And been a bartender for some years. I did it before I went to prison. And people be like, that ain't spiritual. I said, I was told working is real spiritual. I'm just saying, working is spiritual. I love my profession because I'm real good at it. If I ever felt threatened or felt like my sobriety or my recovery was in jeopardy, I would stop. But there's something about the literature that talks about being spiritually fit. And I'm fit. I was fit then and I'm fit now. So this is what I do for a living. Life is different. I got divorced in this process. And let me share about that real quick. I still sometimes suffer with the inability to respond properly to emotional situations that cause me stress. I still do. I was married, hadn't had any intimacy for a year with the woman I was married to. I believe we both held each other hostage And it was just, it didn't work out. And I no longer blame her for it, because I played a big part in the destruction of that marriage. I did too. So, as a man, I disconnected. When I moved out, I disconnected. But I'm thinking, I'm acting like I'm a single man. But I'm not. And somebody came up on me and whispered to me, "I like you." That's all I needed. That's all I needed. And I started traipsing around with this woman in the rooms in front of her. And needless to say, it got real ugly. I had to make amends for that. So the last relationship I was before the one I'm in now, when I broke it off, I chilled for a while. I ain't have nobody. And out of the blue, the God of my understanding, he presented me with not the woman I want to spend the rest of my life with, but the woman I can't live a day without, which is even better. And life is different, man. In this process, man, like I said, I got clean at 23 years old. I was 23 when I got clean. And I see a lot of young cats in here who think that maybe I'm too young for this. They be thinking maybe this is corny. This ain't corny. Death ain't corny. Addiction ain't corny, because it's a respect of no one in here. But I don't know why God saw fit for me to grasp this at such a young age. So here it is, I grow up, and I'm in my 50s now, and here it is, I move to Atlanta, and then not only do I move, it's like most of my network in New York moved down here. So, big brother here, you know, but the one thing about being in the situation that I'm in, regardless as to how much time I got, I'm still the youngest of all of them. So they still tell me sit my ass down. They boss me around like I ain't got no time. I be like, but sit down. And you know what I do? I sit down. Because these are the people who have been with me all these years. These are the people who have raised me and let me know that I could be anything I want to be despite the obstacles that I've overcome. My sponsor. That's all I can say to him is thank you. I've known this man since I was 23 years old. I've known him since I had 2 days clean. I don't care what happened with me. He's always showed up. I slept on his floor in Queens for 3 years every weekend because I followed him around. Where you going this weekend? I'm going here. I'm going too. His wife fed me for 3 years. What you cooking? Don't matter. Just come and eat. Okay, I'm coming. You don't get stuff like that. But in here, man, you make lifelong friends. You know how a lot of us, we ain't real close with our the people that we share blood relations with. But in here, you can pick your family in here. You can pick your family in here. And they're going to ride. And they're going to go with you. Oftentimes, if you pick a member of the heavy hitters, you ain't going to never hear what you want to hear. Never. Never. Please don't come to this retreat or the meetings at the Serenity Club thinking you're going to get soft stroked. They're going to beat you down. But they always pull you aside and tell you, listen, this is why we say this. And this is why we do this. They share their experience with you. So if you new, you young, you old, this is the place. This is if you got a problem with drugs and alcohol, and you don't know what to do with your life, and you're looking for some direction, man, you done tried everything else. You might as well stay here and get it, because this is where it's at. There's something in this I want to read, and I'm gonna shut it down. Living clean, the journey continues, right? It's in the chapter of living our principles, and it says, each of us works our program differently, and it changes for each of us over time. It might mean that we are writing, serving, attending meetings, or we are just practicing a conscious contact with our higher power. Whatever it means for us, we have a responsibility to walk our talk. The idea that if you want what we have, do what we do, has no expiration date. No expiration date. So what does that mean? That means the man with 30 years is subject to cheat on his wife. You might not know the reasons why, but he's subject to do it. That doesn't mean you got the right to judge him. Why don't you ask him why he did it? It means that individuals in here, we are human beings who are subject to make mistakes and errors in judgment, because they're not the same thing. Because you can make a mistake, but if you do it again, ain't no damn mistake. That's self-willing. You're doing what you want to do. So don't come in here talking about, I made a mistake. No, you're doing what you want to do. You're doing what you want to do. And doing what you want to do has always got me what I've always gotten. And it ain't pretty. So in closing, I'm going to tell you this. I'm grateful to the committee for asking me. I'm grateful for the brothers who sat down long enough, who were here before me. People like Pops. We talking about Pops all weekend. I'm sorry if you never met Pops. Boy, you missed a good one. You missed a good one. And I'm not saying that to put Pops on a pedestal, but it was like Pops was, he was the epitome of a heavy hitter. You don't get 50-some-odd years just BSing around. And his energy is missed here. So that's why I'm talking about it. All those predecessors that came before me, that I stand on their shoulder. Funny, connections, Reggie was talking about connections. One of my predecessors that I grew up with in this program in Queens, his son is here. I didn't even know it was his son until last night. This is a dude that took me to coffee, gave me money, put tokens in my hand so I can get to work. This is a do anything I ever asked him for. He took care of me. He looked out for me. You never know who you're sitting here with. But if you're sitting here, man, stay here. And for those who struggle, the struggle is real. The struggle is real. The struggle is real. But surrender is real, too. Surrender is real. I watch. Where Arthur at? Arthur. I watch Arthur. I've been watching Arthur for years. His brother and I are very, very close. I'm close with his family. I know his family. I knew his mother. And I watched Arthur struggle. Man, Arthur ain't struggling. Arthur's so deep in this thing, it don't even make no sense. It don't even make no sense. He here. Yeah. So for anybody that's struggling, you don't have to do anything. But I suggest that you give yourself a break. Hey. I suggest that you do that. I suggest that if you just got high recently, it's in the past. You got to let it rest there. Shame and guilt has no place in the present situation of somebody trying to get clean. Because that's what we do. The literature says half measures what? And this is how I'm going to end. Let me give you a half measure. And I'm going to make some people mad. This is a half measure. I take hypertension medicine. So I take amlodipine and lorstat. One for the high number, one for the low number. I don't know which is which, but I know if I don't take one, I'm only taking half. But this is the same thing. Come in here and get clean. This is what you do. But if you ain't taking the other half, which is the recovery piece, which is 12 sessions, 12 traditions, then this is going to avail you nothing, because eventually you might not ever use a drink or a drug again, but your life will be so damn unmanageable it don't make no sense. Recovery is what happens in our meetings. I got clean, but But being clean ain't enough for me. It ain't enough for me. I want to recover. I want to recover. I want to recover. I don't want to recover things that was lost, like material stuff. I want to recover the ability to make good decisions based on sound information. I want to recover the ability to, when I make an error or I'm making a, I hurt someone, I have the ability to make amends, and I don't have to be pushed to do it, and I don't have to tell anybody else I'm doing. I just tell that person and let it be there. I want to recover the ability to be a human being who is of maximum service to God and His program. Those are the things I'm looking to recover. I want to recover the true essence of myself. These are the things I'm trying to recover. Not a car, because I've lost those. Not another, not an ex-wife. I'm not thinking about that right now. Program is in the book, of course. It's in the book. We know that it's in the book. We got that. But the program is also within the individuals that you walk around with every day. That you see every day. That's what the program is. Because sometimes, and I say this to everybody, you never know. You may be the only basic text or big book that anybody ever reads. They don't know what you're doing, but they know there's something that you're doing that has changed your life. Because you ain't hanging, you ain't on the corner no more. When I go back to Brooklyn, man, I see dudes that I've known all my life. And they still on the block. Still. On the block, 50. One of my partners, man, out there, he doing his thing. He never left the game. And him and a young boy got into it. So, you know, he stayed raised. He can fight. He not throw hands. That young boy didn't want to throw no hands. He threw shells. And he killed him. Right there on the block in front of everybody. I don't know what anybody else's end is going to be. But I want to be like Pops. I want to leave here clean and serene. That's what I want to do. So, in closing, if I said anything that you can get any benefit from, thank God in this program. If I said anything that was in error, if I said anything that was disrespectful, then I ask for your forgiveness as well as God. And I don't have it all, but together, we do. We got it all. We got it all.